Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
Welcome today. Again, here talking about cybersecurity, we have another great guest that I want to introduce you all to, Gib Sorbo. He is the Chief Cybersecurity Strategist for Leidos Corporation. He actually has published a book that we're going to reference quite a few times and have him talk about his experience, but it's titled Smart Grid Security, an End-to-End View of Security in the New Electrical Grid. Gib, welcome today. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
It's good to have you. Good to have your skill set and your reference. We definitely want to hear from people of your caliber to talk about how recommendations and how things should be organized and what we can look at for the best practices in cybersecurity.
Absolutely.
So first of all, Gib, give our listeners a little bit of background on you. Tell us about your career, your life, some personal things. You know, what's your favorite pet? Things like that.
Sure. So I've been doing cybersecurity and IT for about 24 years, and started out as an undergraduate in political science, and like all political science majors, needed a job, and so I went to where all political science majors go, which is to Washington D.C. Couldn't find a job in the area that was appropriate for my major, but I had done some IT in college and used some connections. Used to be a former page in the U.S. Senate, and so my former boss was Deputy Sergeant Arms in the Senate, and was able to find me a position at the Senate Computer Center, and kicked off my career in IT and stuck with it. Gravitated towards the cybersecurity aspect of things. Moved over to the House of Representatives. Did similar work for the Clerk of the House there, and into cybersecurity, and grew that part of IT, and subsequently got a law degree, and was decided still though to stay in cybersecurity for a variety of reasons, and did that for in the House for about another 7 years, and then moved over to the private sector a short period of time with Unisys, and then for the last 12 years working for Leidos, which used to be called SAIC. And been doing that progressively, doing a lot more in commercial cybersecurity work, a lot of work with the utilities industries and with energy in particular. And that's what got me interested in writing the book, and also work in a lot of other industries, healthcare, financial services. So I've been doing that for a while, and been lately focus on building those businesses and solutions for Leidos in my current role.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
This is in critical infrastructure, but you worked in financials, you worked in security, cyber, in a lot of different areas, legal and law. That's interesting. I didn't know that about you. So now, if we asked you, the expert, what is your definition of cybersecurity?
I think the first of all, the word cybersecurity really came out as part of the Comprehensive National Cyber Initiative in the Bush administration. Before that, we all called it information security, which in some ways is a more specific title, which is about the protection of information in wherever it may exist. Cybersecurity has a notion of things like the internet and networks in particular. But, you know, I think the traditional definition of protecting information still holds. You know, while we protect servers and protect equipment, ultimately the goal is to protect the information that's on there. And the, you know, the other goal is really a subsidiary role. I would note, however, that in the area of critical infrastructure, there is a higher priority placed on protection of the equipment and the systems that run it. As one person noted, you know, the normal IT protection is about using physics to protect data, whereas in the critical infrastructure role, it's using data to control physics. And so, in the critical infrastructure, we do have somewhat of a difference, challenge in terms of what's important. With making sure that the integrity of the process is important, followed by keeping availability up, and then confidentiality, which is sometimes the reverse that we see in other areas, particularly in banking or in national security, where the information itself and keeping that private is the most important thing. But it still is, even in critical infrastructure, about the information. We have physical security. We have other things that protect the equipment and the people around it. And, you know, that's related to the cybersecurity, but it is a different discipline. And so we do concentrate on protecting that information, on making sure that as the traditional rule of, you know, confidentiality, integrity, and availability are all preserved in some way or another based on the underlying business process.
Yeah, that's I like your definition. I like that you very clearly, distinctually talk about information security, and it's kind of morphing into what we consider cybersecurity now. And that big difference between critical infrastructure, physical equipments, and the virtual. I look at maybe we can just kind of chat about this. I look at cybersecurity as the connection piece between the physical, the data, and the business operations. And it's kind of the glue that holds it all together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, I think that we all want to, trumpet the areas that we focus on. And there's certainly a lot that needs to be protected, but we don't want to diminish the fact that, you know, there's other aspects. We all have a job to do, and our job is to protect the information in all its forms. And there's other people that also need to protect, and whether it's the physical or other aspects. From a cybersecurity perspective, we're concerned about physical in the sense that it can influence the data, and we want to, from our threat vectors, analyze what sort of physical attacks could interrupt the data. But we also don't want to be so narrow-minded that we forget about protecting people's lives, for example, and other things that may or may not touch on in cyber. Certainly there are some cyber attacks that could threaten lives, but there's also a lot of more traditional physical attacks that can as well. And one good example that I frequently cite is that despite Target experiencing hundreds of millions of dollars in losses, they experience every year about $2 billion in shrinkage, which is the theft of physical items or through employee theft or through consumer theft. And so we always need to put some of that in perspective, that we have a job to do, but it's part of a larger job of protecting things, people, information, for example.
Yeah, it's interesting the numbers you had there about Target, because, you know, I think a lot of times the consumers think of, you know, everybody thinks really only of themselves when it comes down to it. So all the consumers affected look at that breach as a big thing because they were affected, but when the company's affected, people don't really, the general population doesn't really have a heartbreak over that, maybe stockholders or whatever. But I think that's the big difference is, who's affected and what numbers. And if you're one of the people that was affected by Target, and then your identity was, I just did a podcast about identity theft, and it was a tremendous what some criminals had done to go after one of our guests, and literally just he couldn't prove, or they could prove that they were him more than he could prove that he was him in with certain companies, and it was just tremendous. So the person that had that happen as a result of Target just for shopping there really has a different opinion than what I heard you voice, because you know it affected them. But I think right. that's really what it comes down to, is you know, who it affects and in what level, and these big companies have the responsibility for so many people that they affect, and that's we could talk all day about that one. But we have this effort going on in Colorado, and we've been, as part of this podcast series, interviewing a lot of people involved on the political level, and a lot of people just in the community of, you know, what is it that you expect? What are you looking for? You know, setting expectations. And you know, I view this as different than any of the big national standards bodies efforts I've been on, because it's very community focused, and it's more about building a local economy than it is about a technical setting standards or a government organization that was deemed to protect something or create some kind of a cyber program. It's entirely different, and the feel is different and everything. So I want to ping, you know, experts like yourself to say, you know, give some advice to the people, both the administrative people working on what can they do with this community, and the people in the community to understand what to expect. From your experience, and I know we've met on several of the standards bodies that I worked on with you on, so give us some of your opinion on how, first of all, let's talk to the administrative people, the people putting this effort together. What steps should they follow?
Well, I think you want to bring together a community of people that you can build trust. And so certainly efforts, whether it's face-to-face meetings with people or an infrastructure that makes it easy for people to communicate with each other, certainly is a good starting point, and making sure that there's mechanisms to do it with some regularity, that there's mechanisms to prompt discussions. You know, obviously, you know, when people have a problem is when they may think of reaching out, of needing help, of saying, have you seen this type of malware? Have you had any idea how to respond to this particular strain of ransomware or things like that? That's when people, you know, want to reach out, but they only will do so if there is some level of trust in the community that they're reaching out to. Because you know, certainly when there's an incident, there's worries that, you know, the minute that they say something, it's going to leak out to the media, and they won't be able to control the story. And so you know, there's some reluctance there, you know, in you know, not wanting to share sense information about their infrastructure because they're not sure who's what people are going to do with that information. So I think inevitably that's where we see some of the challenges. And I think that if you look at what's worked in other areas, sometimes it's an industry specific group or others, but you know, what's always worked well is some degree of trust, some degree of camaraderie, in the sense that people are experiencing some of the same things, that you have some of an affinity, that the group isn't too broad-based, that people can't really see the connection to themselves, and you know, community is one of those affinities. But it's in cyber, it's always a challenge, because there's the perception of cyber is, well, that's, you know, everywhere. It doesn't really know a sort of physical boundary in some ways, but people are bound by physical boundaries, whether they acknowledge it or not. And I think that's, again, people look to trust. They look for ways that they can develop that affinity, and one of those is the interpersonal interactions, the in-person interactions in many cases, that you can sort of imitate online to some extent, and to some degree those things do work, but there's really no replacing for the the in-person interactions. And I think that's what a community like yours is that's being built. That's one of its major strengths, as opposed to those that are completely online or that have maybe infrequent meetings, like industry associations and other things like that. It's really tough to develop that level of trust that you need if you don't have that frequent interaction.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
Yeah, you know, I wonder where the balance is between, you know, literally we're talking about community, people that can get together and face to face, but this cyber worldwide, there's a virtual. What do you think about, virtually building trust? How's that done?
Well, it's done a lot of ways. It usually takes longer. The word trust, there's a speaker on a TED talk that talked about there's like three levels of trust that you usually talk about when you talk about people. One is competence, that, you know, somebody, you know, they may be the most the nicest person in the world, but, you know, they may not, you know, may not want them to do a open heart surgery on you because they're just not trained to do it. Then you have the reliability, you know, if somebody says they're going to be there at 5 o'clock, are they? And, you know, some people are more reliable than others. Again, they may be very sincere, but they just, you know, time gets away from them. And then the last category is what people normally associate with trust, which is, you know, sincerity, you know, not, you know, intentionally trying to harm somebody or to say a blatant lie or something else like that. And those are the people that you really are looking for, is the ones that you have some, you know, belief that they are, you know, looking out for you, that they're, at least, if they're focused on their self-interest, it's more enlightened self-interest, that they're not going to take advantage of somebody just for a short-term advantage or something else like that. I think that I always, in business, what you have to look at, you know, Churchill said there are no permanent alliances, only permanent interests. And I think in those cases, that's why you see things built up around common interests, common goals, that, you know, there are associations, plenty of them, that where competitors work together, mm-hmm. And that can work too. It's just a matter of designing them in a way. And some of that's just simply because people, those of us who work in cybersecurity, if we're, you know, all in energy or oil and gas or some, I guess, utilities is a bad example because they don't often compete, but there's others where, like retail or financial services, where they do compete and they have worked fairly well together, because there's enough of a separation between the competition aspect of their business and what they do on a day-to-day basis. In this case, cybersecurity, and you can build a level of trust because it's in everyone's interest to do that, and they really wouldn't necessarily gain as much by taking advantage of somebody's trust. And so that's certainly one way to look at it. Another is really about having enough interactions to really build that trust. I think there's a conscious trust that people will say, well, I need to see some evidence that somebody is either trustworthy, or if they say they're going to do something, they'll do something, and then I'll share more of my information. And then there's the unconscious sense, which is that you just need to build up that interaction over time, almost like the caveman brain concept, which basically you're just There just needs to be a certain familiarity. People can't always pin it down, but it usually has to do with the frequency of interactions. And so within person, I think you can do that much quicker, but online and through other communication methods, you can do that. I think it just both takes both time and the frequency of the interactions with, you know, one, you know, supporting the other. And I think if you create an environment where people are have an opportunity and have a reason to communicate on a regular basis, I think you inevitably that build that trust. And I think the parts where things fail or at least don't succeed as well as you want is that there just aren't enough opportunities to interact or enough reasons to interact, I should say. I mean, the opportunity may be there, but they don't see, you know, an advantage in, of interacting. And so whether it's, you know, there are, you know, other means that people will use, social aspects or other things just to get people to interact. And I think if you can come up with a reason for people to interact, even if it doesn't necessarily advance some particular, you know, goal in terms of the organizational charter, but it helps to build trust and build familiarity and affinity, then I think that's an advantage. And, you know, sometimes it just takes a little creativity to come up with, you know, those reasons to connect on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. So how much, I mean, we're talking here about, you know, the building of trust, person to person, organization to organization. Is there a technical aspect that there's that we can build trust? You know, the internet's full of anonymous transactions and things like, then you'll never be able to have a relationship like that with everybody that you're going to do business with eventually. What are your thoughts for maybe furthering that trust over a, you know, a technical approach or something online that for the anonymous aspect?
Well, I think there's groups that do that. I mean, the companies like Spiceworks sort of build those communities, and there's other ones like that around technical communities that encourage that interaction communication. And it is, in some ways, it is surprising how easy it is for people to at least engage and share information. They may not share their most personal or their most sensitive information, but they'll, you know, they'll talk about a particular product or other things. Sometimes it just really, you need to be able to have enough mechanisms. Sometimes it could be a training on a particular subject. Ask somebody, you know, it sounds like you're an expert in X. Can you just write a few paragraphs about what you do and post it up there? And let's have a discussion about that. Sometimes maybe not necessarily something provocative, but something that at least causes people to, you know, state an opinion, and not necessarily in any hostile way, but just to, you know, causes people to think about it. I know when I write a blog post, if I'm not worked up about something, I'm not going to write it because it's not interesting enough to me to just, you know, write in an encyclopedia entry, for example, or something like that. And so I think with a lot of people, that's the case, where if you give them something either that they're passionate about or that they just happen to know something about and say, can you talk about that? And you could be in a, you know, even an audio forum like similar like this or something like that. But something that sparks interest. And then I think from there, one of the ways that people really start building trust is that they detect passion in people. They look for the you know, because when people are passionate about something, usually more genuine, and there's more reason to sort of believe them and to trust what they're saying because of that passion, particularly if it's not artificial or you know, used to, you know, in some sort of contrived way, that it's in other words, they don't have any particular reason why they would, you know, show that passion. They're not going to gain from it, at least in the short term, to show some passion in some subject that they may not. But if you allow that just to naturally come out, where you see where people really feel strongly about something, and then you have the added advantage not just of building trust, but of really coming up with discrete areas of expertise that your community then can be relied upon. So you actually get reliable information. You almost build somewhat of an expert system in some ways, at least within your community, that then in not in, in addition to, you know, people being willing to share things, you actually have a, you know, a repository of knowledge essentially in the individuals that, you know, if there's a particular subject or who knows something on this product, well, and maybe that's something that can be done in parallel, where as people share their passions or share their knowledge, there's some sort of documentation or at least pointers to that knowledge online to be able to say, okay, for this subject, these people are very knowledgeable on that, and that helps both with newcomers into the community that they know where they can look, as well as people that, you know, may not have been aware of that because they hadn't participated in every forum, or simply over time they just forget. And so then that can help them. And then that's another way that you build trust, is that somebody says, oh, I need to know how to do X. They may not be sharing with that person any sensitive information at the moment, but when that person comes back and says, oh yeah, this is how I would configure that firewall or do this or do that, that's another way of building trust, and usually people will be willing to reciprocate in that way. And, you know, surprisingly over time, in addition to, you know, building up, providing some useful information, the community tends to trust each other a lot more as a result too.
Okay. You know, I have noticed in general, we'll say that, in the cybersecurity community, and people that are at the heart of their organization with their organization's private information, we're very skeptical. So this distrust piece has been difficult for us, we're just, the nature of the personalities involved usually don't have that openness. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's been the thing I've seen, that, you know, even in other industries, that building that trust and this interaction is a little bit more easily done. So I guess one of the things I would say with my passion towards this is we have to say, let's drop that skeptical a little bit in order to start the communication that builds this towards a positive direction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that's, some of it is the nature of the business. Some of it is you sort of get some of the geekiness of some of the individuals, not just with cybersecurity, but with IT and other things in general that may also make it more difficult. They're not necessarily the most sharing group by nature, in terms of, you know, they may prefer to do more things on their own. And so, so you also need to, acknowledge that and really understand who they are. I mean, you get running, you know, jokes about, you know, if you're in a group of, you know, salespeople, turn it into a competition because that's what they like to do. If you're mm-hmm. in a group of engineers, allow them to show how smart they are because that's, you know, what they like to do. And so there's different, you know, understanding your audience and what sort of, you know, are they managers? Are they technical? Are they, you know, the are they coders? Focus on other aspects? And then you can start to get an understanding of what will really bring them out and what sort of techniques will get them to share that information. Because sometimes if you keep it on a very technical note, they don't even realize that they're engaging with other people in a way that they would normally not feel comfortable doing. Mm-hmm. But because they can use that, you know, the technical stuff as a little bit of a cover, it's surprising how much people will share if they don't feel like they're put in an uncomfortable position.
Yeah, I think that's just a nature of the personality types that we usually find in these very highly technical career fields that we have to adapt to. Like you said, mm-hmm. that's a very good example of, you know, if you're in sales, it's a competition, you know, and that's a perfect thing kind of lead into the last thing I would kind of ask to talk about is from the community aspect. And now, having been to years and years of some of the standards group meetings, and I have pulled away at different times because, you know, one, we're right on the first conversation, the trust was lost. it started to focus around some larger organizations that had self-interest at mind, and once again goes back to the trust. And then the funding went away, so the incentive for people to keep coming back kind of dried up as well. So if we're looking at the mass pulling in groups of people to make an effort like this work, what do we say to everybody out there to make this, you know, a success? And what would be a success?
Well, I think you have to be cognizant of what is going to keep it going. If it requires the funding of a large company or something to get people there, you know, that's going to have a limited lifespan unless there's some compelling reason why that organization should continue to fund it. Ultimately, it needs to be a group that, number one, they feel like they can get enough out of doing there. Some of the administrivia, certainly it helps if you have a location, even if it's a company that's just providing a conference room for free. If you have an in-person meeting and it's no real extra cost to them, I mean, sometimes off hours it gets a little tricky with security and stuff like that. But if that can be worked out, that can improve the situation because it's a predictable location, and sometimes shifting around helps, but a lot of times people are, you lose people because they forget where it is. So I think some of that is helpful. So some regularity in how you're doing things, if it's in person, and even if it's online, again, that's where you want to have that regularity. Succession challenges are always an issue where individuals that are running the things may change depending upon their interest or their careers or other things like that. So you want to look for succession planning and mechanisms to keep it going after some of the original leadership moves on. So I think that's always key. But, also I think that it does take a little effort to get, particularly in this area where you have the underlying organizations that are really the beneficiaries of all that exchange. There is where people see those sorts of things helpful to their organization, the funding is usually there. I think it's where people they start out with saying, well, okay, sounds like a good thing, I'll throw us a little money at it. But, then they really want to see some sort of ROI associated with either the benefit to their people or to their organization. And if they see, because there's really, for these types of organizations, the costs are not that high, they will, continue to support that. It's just a matter of continuing to see that benefit to them. And, there's some other advantages if you have quote unquote sponsors in a way where somebody's not necessarily doing a direct sales pitch, but you can there's lots of ways where people can, it's easier to justify. I mean, when I've asked to sponsor or to support some organization, it's probably easier to make the marketing argument if I'm selling something that then trying to make the argument about that the value of exchanging information is going to be useful, in part because nobody understands whether marketing works or not. So it's somewhat easier in some cases to say, oh yeah, well, we're getting our name out there, that's good enough. And and sometimes that's all you really need. And there's lots of organizations that have done real well with just having allowing somebody to put their signage up, and have if it's an in-person event, having some literature out. It's not people don't have to it's not a forced pitch, or people don't have to listen to it, but it's there if people want to learn more. And sometimes those sorts of you definitely don't want to push against those sorts of options, because they can really sustain your organization. And as long as it's not too overt in terms of how strong the sales pitch is, and everybody understands, yes, they're a sponsor, but they're not controlling the dialogue in the organization, that I think can be beneficial to you in the long run, because like I said, interests do matter. And if someone feels that they have a community that may benefit from the services or products that they sell, then they're likely to do that. And from an individual participant level, hey, I'm fine with that. It's not costing me money, which is usually the alternative, is you have to, everybody has to pay dues, or everybody has to pay something. that becomes more challenging over time in many cases. But, you know, that can work too. So I think that, you know, the success is really about people feeling that that they have a level of trust that when they have an incident or they have an issue that comes up, that, you know, they're willing to pick up the phone and call a certain number of people to get either advice or to find out if they've experienced other things, and that they're willing to share in a way which is not, you know, overly guarded, that, you know, they don't have to talk in sort of you know, generalities, that they can say, you know, this is where it looks like this is how it was breached. Did somebody clicked on a link that they shouldn't have? It got in their computer and it did this. You know, what are the most likely ways that we can detect whether somebody's compromised it, or and things like that? So I think that's the definition of success, and that sort of community is really having somebody willing to, and I don't expect them to share it with everybody in the group, but at least with among certain individuals when they have an issue like that, to be able to pick up the phone or even send an email in some cases to get more information or to get some help.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Gib, thanks so much for joining today. I wanted to give you an opportunity to say a little bit about Leidos, and what you do there, and how people might be interested in checking into you, and for what reasons.
Sure. So Leidos is a $5 billion systems integrator. We do about 2/3 of our work with the federal government in a variety of ways, everything from providing intelligence analysts to doing environmental remediation on oil spills or other things in a wide variety of areas for the federal government, as well as certain select commercial industries, in particular energy, as well as healthcare, and then in our cybersecurity area. In our commercial cyber, we focus on all verticals, but, you know, have some strengths in areas around healthcare, critical infrastructure, financial services, and others. And particularly in cybersecurity, we do a full life cycle of cybersecurity services, from initial assessments and pen tests and other areas to help a customer figure out where their security is and where it needs to go, all the way through systems integration of new products and new processes, finally to our managed security services offering, which does 24/7 monitoring of their infrastructure and is highly focused on the customer's needs. It's what we call high touch to support what their needs are, and not just giving a one-size-fits-all solution.
Well, great, and thanks a lot for joining today, Gib. We definitely got a lot of good information, and I hope that the people listening can take something from it as to, you know, what works and what some of the experts will give you advice on this organization, organizing this effort for Colorado. But thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Right. You too. Thanks.
Bye.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.